my oldest daughter at the time was like 6 or 7. And we had told her, you know, when George had moved in, don't let anybody know that George lives here. That's the last thing. You don't tell anybody about that. And she said, you know, she said, okay. And it was like 3 months into her first year of school, and they're driving home with 3 older girls. And I guess they hear Faith or something on the radio, and the girls are saying, yeah, we're going to see him. We got concert tickets to the show. And they were like 11 or 12 years old. And as they were driving down our driveway to drop Rachel off at home, Rachel interjected to be part of the conversation. She said, oh, well, George lives with us.
Have you ever heard of the marshmallow test? A child sits in a room, and in front of the child is a marshmallow on a plate. This child is told, we're going to leave you for just a few minutes, and if you don't eat the marshmallow, we'll bring you another one. But if you eat that marshmallow, that's it. Watching those children squirm in their seats and lick their lips trying to resist temptation is torture. George was the marshmallow. And even though his friend and manager, Rob Kahane, gave his daughter fair warning, I don't think any of us can blame her for giving in to temptation.
They started laughing. They said, yeah, sure. And she started crying. And she said, look, there's his car. And they were laughing. And she said, well, just come into the house and I'll show you he lives here. So they got out of the car. The mother was kind of telling Rachel that she shouldn't be making up lies. And they walk into the house and George is on the couch in the living room in his underwear. And they walk in like one of those Hollywood buses, you know, that go by that are staring at all the people. And she came through the living room and she said, see, there he is. Yeah, it was quite, George had said at dinner that night. Yeah, it was quite funny. It was like these people were walking by and just pointing at me. It was really kind of strange, but it's fun.
When most people think about George Michael, they think of him as either the sexy 80s icon with blonde highlights swinging his hips in a leather jacket, or they think of him hiding behind sunglasses under the flashbulbs of paparazzi and scandal. I now prefer to think of him lounging around in a cozy living room, watching rubbish TV in his underoos, dreaming up of songs we'll all be singing for the rest of our lives. And maybe by the end of this episode, you'll be thinking differently of him as well. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupniak. Yoros Giago Panayotou was born on June 25th, 1963 in London. He was raised in a very working class home. His parents used to work in a fish and chip shop. His mother actually worked 2 jobs and raised 3 children. Just so she could spend time with her husband, she would work in the restaurant at night. George always said he had a lovely childhood, but he remembered his parents were very stressed and always exhausted. George's upbringing was very modest. His father didn't believe in vanity. He called it a sin. They didn't have flashy clothes or stylish coifs. He wanted his family to stay grounded and realistic, and he didn't support George's talents and ambitions. When George changed schools, he sat next to a confident young man called Andrew Ridgely. Andrew was excited about the new kid, and they hit it off instantly. George looked up to him and began to write songs and perform. They started a band called The Executive and recorded a demo. The 3 songs on the demo were Careless Whisper, Club Tropicana, and The Wham Rap. On the last day in the studio, the head of Intervision Records took the young men to a dive cafe and threatened that if they didn't sign a record deal with him, then they couldn't have their demo. They were blackmailed into their first record deal, and they had no idea what they were getting into. They were scared, so they signed on the dotted line. After a band dropped out of the music show Top of the Pops, Wham snuck in and gave a mesmerizing performance. George was shirtless in a leather vest and dancing his heart out. Britain was smitten, and their album jumped to number 1 the next week. While filming videos for their debut album, George came out of the closet to his fellow band members. They rallied around him and supported him, but they were worried about his professional image and how his family were going to take it. I mean, all of this uncertainty and pressure was coming at a time when fame was speeding towards them like a freight train filled with screaming young girls obsessed with the dynamic duo. But now, Britain was buzzing with Wham fever, and the natural next step for George and Andrew would be conquering America. That's when they met Rob Kahane.
They called me and they said they were having problems with their agent, and would I come over and pitch, you know, the Wham tour? I didn't know at the time that George was planning on this being the last tour, but he didn't even want to do that with Andrew at the time. He just wanted to move on to be George Michael. So I had to go over to England and convince him. And one of the ways I convinced him was to tell him the date in Florida, Miami, had already gone on sale and sold out.
It didn't take long for America to fall head over heels for the handsome duo. But shortly after America fell in love with Wham, Wham split up, amicably. They knew they took the adolescent fantasy as far as they could, and they wanted to walk away on a high. They didn't believe they could carry it into adulthood, and George, well, he wanted to prove himself as an artist.
I thought he was going to be a major star. And I actually thought Wham was, if it stayed together, would have, you know, it would have been gigantic. But after knowing him for a bit, I understood why he wanted to go on his own.
Now that George was on his own, it was time to break through. And what better way than with a bit of faith?
What he would do in the studio is he would record like the first verse of Father Figure. And then he had only written the first verse. Then he would have to drive. He either needed to drive, be on a plane or a train, something moving for him to complete the writing process. It was really interesting. So he would leave the studio after the first verse and drive for 2 or 3 hours and come back and then do the second verse. And then the same process. So it would take forever to finish the song. But I mean, they were great songs, so it was worth it. When he turned in the album, the intro to the album was 30 seconds of Faith. There was no other music recorded except the first 30 seconds. And when George asked me what I thought of the album, I obviously told him I thought, you know, there were 5, 6 singles on the album. But I said to him, why don't you finish the Faith song? It sounds like a hit. And he kind of, you know, I wouldn't say that was our first big argument, because he told me that, you know, it's only an intro and, you know, you stick to the business part, I'll do the music and that kind of conversation. So he came to L.A. as Wham and then as George and was staying at hotels, but there were tons of paparazzi around. And I remember picking him up and he wanted to lay out in the sun. So I brought him to my house where I live with my family, and he loved the backyard of the house and this music and the fact there were no paparazzi or people bothering him. So he came for a day and then stayed for the next 6 years. So he was living with us at the time that I told him about it. And when he came back from Vancouver, he said, you know, I think I'm going to go to the studio and finish this Faith song. He made it sound like, you know, he had never talked to me about it. So I said, geez, you know, that'd be a really good idea. You know, why don't you do that? So he went and he finished it and obviously became the name of the album and the first single. So I guess it was kind of worth the conversation.
After months of careful planning, George was ready to release Faith to the world, and the fans were chomping at the bit. But George had a very specific request, and his publicist, Phil Lobel, was the perfect man for the job.
So I go up to the house. The housekeeper lets me in the front door. I go to the den. Nobody's there. I'm sitting there waiting for Rob to show up, Kahane and Michael Lippman, the managers. And in walks in a tennis outfit, George Michael. He sits down in front of me. He goes, hi, I'm George. You must be Phil. I go, yes, hi, yes, I'm Phil. He said, oh, Rob said a lot of good things about you. But do you know, I don't want to do interviews on this tour. It's the first thing out of his mouth. And I go, okay, well, you know, being creative, that's just the mode that I come from. And if you don't want to talk to the media, that's okay. And he looks at me and he goes, wait, so you're telling me that you will be my publicist and you're not going to make me do interviews? I said, I'm not going to make you do whatever you don't want to do, George. He says, okay, well, great. Hey, it's nice meeting you. I have my tennis lesson out in the backyard. thanks for coming by. And he walks out of the room. It was under 5 minutes I was with him. So I'm sitting there going, well, that was an easy interview. Then suddenly Rob walks in the room and he goes, have you seen George? And I said, yeah, we had a meeting and he left. He's out on the tennis court. He goes, oh, okay, you didn't tell me how to do any interviews, right? And I go, no, I followed your directions. I said I would figure out ways to get him press without him doing interviews. And Rob goes, great. Okay, well, hey, Phil, thanks for coming by. We'll let you know. And that was Friday afternoon. So I'm waiting Saturday for a call. I'm waiting Sunday for a call to get some feedback. Finally, I haven't heard anything all weekend long. And I call on Monday and I get Rob on the phone and I say, hey, so what did George say about our interview and time together? And Rob goes, and I'll never forget these words, he said nothing. It's a fait accompli. We're hiring you. You're the first publicist he hasn't said no to. Send me your invoice. And that's how I got hired to be George Michael's publicist on the Faith Tour, the biggest album of his career.
George may not have been a fan of promoting himself, but I'm happy to promote the sponsor you're about to hear from. And when we come back, we'll find out how George used a catwalk to find freedom. A Life Lived is sponsored this week by Freetrade, the commission-free stock trading and investment app. Now, we all know that investing is one of the best ways to grow wealth over the long term. But if you're anything like me, you'll have been put off by high commissions and clunky products from traditional stockbrokers and all that jargon that makes it complicated for, you know, regular people to start investing. Freetrade is on a mission to break down these barriers by opening up stock investing to everybody. So while other stockbrokers will charge up to £12 for every trade, Freetrade, as the name suggests, doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can invest and keep more of your profits. Freetrade's beautifully designed and award-winning app is used by over 250,000 people. It's authorized by the Financial Conduct Authority, and it's protected by the FSCS, so you can buy and sell stocks and other investments with confidence. Want another reason to feel secure? Freetrade has been the winner of the British Bank Awards 2 years in a row for Best Online Trading Platform. Sign up to Freetrade today by heading to freetrade.io/AlifeLived. And once you create your account, you'll get a randomly allocated free share for a company like Greggs, Rightmove, or even Apple, worth between £3 and £200. Now, of course, whenever you invest, your capital is at risk. The value of investments can go down as well as up, and you may receive back less than your original investment. For more information, visit freetrade.io. That's freetrade.io. George's tight jeans, swiveling hips, and leather jacket meant becoming a heartthrob was inevitable.
He was very, very hands-on with every aspect of the creativity of the album and the tour. Nothing happened or went by him without him signing off on it. He's got the top people around him, and he is taking ideas and using their technical skills to bring it to fruition. So overall, that's what made it successful. But ultimately, everything is George's vision, from the words to the sound to the writing to the producing to the staging to how the lighting is comes off on stage. It was all George's vision that other people would put into place.
By 1988, he was the biggest pop star in the world. Faith was the number one album in the UK for 1 week, number one in USA for 12 weeks, and had 4 number one hit singles and 1 number two. The 1980s was ruled by an elite circle of solo artists: Madonna, Bruce Springsteen, Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, Whitney Houston. They were more than celebrities. They were royalty. And George was one of the shiniest new members. But George admitted that though he strived for fame, it scared him. He never enjoyed being the center of media spotlight. He was ambushed by fans and paparazzi everywhere he went. It was overwhelming. When you've built a vastly adored public persona as a hunk, but you're getting to grips with your sexual identity in secrecy, it's hard to look people in the eye. In the beginning, he admits the spotlight fed his ego, but in later years, he just wanted to express himself as an artist. That's how he wanted the media to see him, not as a sexual object, but as a person. So he decided, best not to meet them at all.
I call Rob up and I say, Rob, is there any interview that he has done to date about this record that I could get my hands on? And Rob says, well, actually, you know, we just finished for the MTV networks, for VH1 and MTV, a lengthy 3-hour sit-down interview on camera that George was in total control of. He set up the lighting, set up the camera angles, and sat down and answered the questions about every song on the record. And I said, you're kidding me. Really? I said, well, where is this video? He says, let me send you the video and tell me what you think. I said, well, I have a fax machine. If I can get media to fax me questions specifically about the album, I can go into this computer and search out any song that he's talking about or any topic he's talking about off the album and have his answers in his own words for fax interviews. And he goes, wow, that's a great idea. He said, just let us know who the media are and what you're doing. But yeah, those are George's words. Use his words any way, shape, or form that you can for everyone. I go, great, thanks. So suddenly now I went from not having George available for interviews to having a lengthy, literally, I must have been 60 pages in my new Apple Macintosh where I could search out George's discussions about every song on the album. And what I had to do now was get media that were interested in this album to agree to an interview via fax. And I did just that with 126 interviews through the course of 12 months on the Faith Tour and on the album. And when they were reluctant to do a fax interview, I would say, listen, I can tell you that these are George's words. George really wants to be in your publication. He really is committed to making this album a success, and he really is relying on the media to take the words that have come from his heart and pour it out into this Faith album and reach the public. So I assure you these will be George's words and George's answers, and I would never take it upon myself to be making up answers for an artist like George Michael. And I got every publication to agree to send me faxes with questions. And those questions that veered into the personal aspects of his life, we just ignored because they weren't on the transcript.
I love that album. I love that album so much. I think it's so timeless. I remember I Want Your Sex. I remember that video, and it is so tantalizing and exciting and groundbreaking. I mean, controversial for its time. Yes, very controversial. MTV would only run it in the later hours of the evening. He couldn't even get day play for it. But it was enticing at that moment because it wasn't advertising promiscuity. It was more about ownership of your sexuality and exploring it and telling people to stop being so sheltered by it. And that was groundbreaking.
It was, in its essence, in how he portrayed himself, a cover for his being gay, because it was a very heterosexual video. And everybody knew, I mean, whether you're gay, bi, straight, trans, you related to and understood what his message and meaning was of the song. However, for the video itself, it was presenting him and his quote-unquote girlfriend in this very sensual video that in essence, was denying his homosexuality.
While every girl in the world had their eyes on George, he was trying to stay low-key. But he found time to have fun with his friends. And he made a few new ones.
He recruited a bunch of us to play water volleyball. And then he said, oh, we need a referee. And I just happened to have one of my close friends there that was smitten with George Michael. Very young guy, Stephen, who was about 21 at the time. And he had come down just to hang out because he knew we would be by the pool. He'd come down from Los Angeles. And so I said, hey, my friend Stephen's over there by the pool. Stephen, come and ref this volleyball game for us. And Stephen reluctantly comes to the edge of the pool and waves at George and says, hi, George. And suddenly George, just his face just lightens up, and with his big smile and this twinkle in his eye, because he's clearly smitten by my friend.
Faith was even topping the black music charts in America. That was a big deal for George because he gained so much influence from soul music, and he used it in his music.
One of the first things we did in order to cross him over to a more mainstream adult audience was I found that song through Clive Davis that he sang with Aretha Franklin. And to get him to sing somebody else's song was hard enough. But then when we found it, we were going to do it with Stevie Wonder, and we didn't end up because Stevie Wonder never showed up to the studio. So we ended up flying to Detroit to record with her. And that helped change his career totally. For a white guy to sing with Aretha during that time and being able to not only hold his own, but have like a number one in, I don't know, 100 countries or something crazy, gave him exposure to an older audience and certainly to a black audience.
After winning a Grammy for Best Male R&B Artist, George was flattered. The honor was usually awarded to a black man, but the black audience was offended. George was getting substantial play on black radio stations, and suddenly it came to a halt.
When he came to America, he kept saying to me, why is there a thing called the black chart? What, do you have to be black to be on the black chart? He goes, my favorite artists are on the black chart, but my music, black people love my music, so why can't I be on the black chart? And he goes, and we should change the name of the black chart. That's stupid. There was a lot of prejudice going on in the record business. And when we first were coming out with the album, he wanted the black department to be working the album at Sony. So we had a big meeting about it. And he said, look, it's important for my record to be number one pop. I know I'm going to get that, but I want a number one black album. And he goes, while we're at it, why don't we set up a meeting with Billboard and change the name to like Urban or something? This doesn't discount white people or Asian people or, you know, whatever. And so a week later, after we met with Billboard, they changed the name of the chart. We had the number one black album or urban album. Number two was Michael Jackson. Number three was Janet Jackson. Number four was Prince. And, you know, the list went on of those kind of artists that he was ahead of. So he loved that more than anything, is being number one on that chart.
George was a magician, a ringleader, an artist, and he threw all of his energy into his performances. When you saw George on stage, you saw it all. He held nothing back.
He would be standing up on top of the speaker stacks with his butt to the audience, and suddenly that guitar strumming would happen, and a spotlight would go on his back. And that's how that show opened. And it was 80% girls, the shows. And the screaming was just like you'd witnessed or heard about or saw on TV from the Beatles. It was just really one of the most incredible experiences of my life. And having been to so many shows and tours and thousands of artists that I had promoted as a promoter, to now be a publicist with this master entertainer that is just bringing the crowd to their feet for the entire show, other than the slow ballads where they would be sitting in rapture as he's, you know, strumming his guitar. It was just an incredible experience for me too.
When you leave everything on stage, you can't help but walk off feeling empty.
After the shows, I think those were the most difficult times, because you go from the stage adulation of 18,000, 20,000 people into a limo wrapped in your bathrobe because you're covered with sweat and a towel around you to your hotel room. Your hotel room door closes and you're alone and you're the hottest artist in the world. And how is that going to make you feel?
George really struggled with this tidal wave of celebrity. He was used to being famous, but he was miserable. He couldn't go out with friends. He was in the closet, even to most of his American crew and support staff. He had the image and the notoriety, but no freedom. And he was incredibly lonely.
George was, as history now records, very in the closet. To not only his family, I mean, to everybody. To his sister, who was on the tour that did his hair and makeup every night. To his parents, to even his managers. And I tell you, I was two-thirds through the tour, and we were in Texas. On that weekend, during the day, we actually had time at the Four Seasons Hotel, and Rob and I were sitting poolside, having a drink, talking about the last 6-7 months and the success we've had. Suddenly he turns to me and says, "Phil, do you think George is gay?" And I'm like, the look on my face, I'm just astounded because, you know, I've known Rob since college years, and Rob's George's manager, and before that was his agent. And I say to him, "You mean you don't know?" He says, "Oh, no, George has never spoken to me or anybody about his private life, his private sex life. So we don't know. I mean, we kind of assume, but we don't know." And I remember what I said to him was, "Well, Rob, while I can't say firsthand because I've never slept with George Michael, I have plenty of friends in London that have." And he goes, "Oh, well, that's what I thought. I mean, but he's never spoken to us about this. And that's the reason why he's so miserable on this tour." And I said, "Miserable how?" And Rob said, "Well, he goes back to his room alone every night. You know, at the beginning of the tour, we had this scenario where Kathy Young, the Asian girl in his I Want Your Sex video, would go back to the room with him. And it was an adjoining room. So she would go to her room and he would go to his room. And we had that going on for the first couple of months, but that got old. And George is back in his room alone every night, just hating the tour. And it's just miserable being on the road. And occasionally he comes out of his shell when we'll have an after party or there's a volleyball game in the pool during a daytime when there's no rehearsal. But by and large, he's miserable." And I said, that's a shame. I said, it was such a successful album and such a successful career, and being on the top of the charts and being number one in the world right now, to be on the road and be so miserable, it's got to be very painful. And Rob said, "Yes, I mean, it is. It's something that we have to deal with daily."
George knew that for his next album, he couldn't handle promoting it with the press. He was very honest with Sony Records about it, but they just couldn't understand.
He didn't want to address any questions that came up about his sexuality because there'd been plenty of rumors for years. I mean, you look at his Wham videos and you wouldn't think that there's any question. I mean, people also thought Andrew was gay, but Andrew wasn't. But George didn't want to be confronted by those questions. And when I would get email interviews, maybe 1 in 10 email interviews would address his sexuality. And of course, we would just ignore those interviews or those questions and not answer them. We only focused on the music itself. And of course, what I had available to me was George talking about only the music on the Faith album. So we would just ignore those questions, or I would ignore those questions. And, you know, if there were 10 questions and one of them was about his sexuality, they would get answers back on 9. And nobody ever pushed on that, like, "Oh, you didn't answer question number 7. And it's like, even if they did ask, I would just say, George chose not to address that.
Listen Without Prejudice was a message to the world. I'm an artist, and my music is my medium. Just enjoy it and respect me for making it. But this is a language celebrity doesn't understand. The album only sold 1 million copies, and George was hurt. He blamed the record label, claiming they didn't promote it properly. To try to drive and promote the album and songs like Freedom, George got clever. His music video features the top supermodels of the time in mood rooms, lip-singing to his song. If you're not going to watch George perform, Cindy Crawford, Naomi Campbell, Christy Turlington, Tatiana Petites, and Linda Evangelista are a pretty good substitute. Director David Fincher gave the video the right balance of being enticing and edgy. Burning the iconic leather jacket, the exploding guitar, and the jukebox was George saying, "That's it. I'm done with this."
It was clear that George emotionally was a tortured soul. And that tortured soul, even when he came out, it just led to so many problems, which I can't address because, again, I was only with George on the Faith tour and the Faith album. But I always thought George would be one of the most prolific singer and songwriters ever in the history of music. And while he did create many more great songs and anthems, there was always personal issues and personal problems that sidetracked him from his creative process. And, you know, it really stemmed from those, I think, those earliest years when he was, in fact, this very tortured soul that was using his music to express his creativity and his brilliance.
Thank you so much for listening, but we're not letting the sun go down on George yet. Listen to part two of George Michael to find out how love and loss inspired George to write Jesus to a Child.